This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothi McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting. From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette,
the political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm Connor Boyle. Coming up on the program, an imaginative exploration of future worlds. What might that look like, and how can we make the future a little better starting today? This is a special episode brought to you by Intelligence Squared in partnership with WhyTree. Our host on today's show is the journalist, author, and former editorial director of BBC News, Kamal Ahmed. Here's Kamal with more.
The future.
New horizons. In a restless search for new opportunities and new ways of living.
This was a promotional video for General Motors created in 1940, laying out their vision for the future cities of 1960. Throughout history, we've had visions of it. Some right and some, well, not so right. And some of us will remember tomorrow's world, with flying aero cars and free energy.
And the dream of being able to flick a switch on your car and fly off out of the chaos on the roads must have been around almost since traffic jams began. Well now, if you have around £15,000 to spare, it need no longer be a dream. This aero car is the...
We haven't always got our predictions right. But nearly every decision human beings have ever made has involved factoring in a sense of what the future is likely to hold.
It's always been with us. It's always been part of planning. When you think from the first farmer wondering if the crops are going to come in, all of that is part of trying to create a better future for the people that we love.
But I want to know if things are different now, at this point in human history. With access to such advanced science and technology, is it fair to say that we can say what's coming our way in numerous fields with an unprecedented degree of confidence?
It has become possible to see what is happening in any spot of the world, and that has created hopes that we would be able to predict the future.
And if we can, should we?
People maybe don't think it through. What if you did know? Do you really want to know what the future is?
Come, let's travel into the future. What will we see?
Welcome to the Futureverse. I'm Kamal Ahmed. In this series, brought to you by Intelligence Squared and WhyTree, we'll talk to some of our smartest thinkers about the future. Where are we heading? How could we individually and as a society shape our future for good? Will the world be a better place in 5 years, in 50 years, in 500 years? I'll be exploring this in the coming months and inviting you to join me. Look out for videos and podcast episodes. And we will be hosting an exclusive event that you can attend. More details on that at the end of the episode. And you can find us on social media. Hashtag Futureverse. But first, I want to get to the bottom of the future as an idea. When I was a child, the future seemed exciting. Everything was going to be cleaner, faster, and just a bit better. We would be able to buy anything we wanted as consumerism took hold and promised us more leisure time and less work. Is the future a modern idea? Or has it always preoccupied us? A new book by Oded Gelor, The Journey of Humanity, argues that for most of human history, day-to-day life changed very little. Even while cities sprang up and we invented the wheel and mastered the seas, life was hard and brutal, and life expectancy and living conditions remained stagnant. And then, in the 19th and 20th centuries, we hit a boom in human fortune. Life expectancy more than doubled, and per capita income soared 14-fold across planet Earth. All in a mere split second, if you consider the full expanse of human existence. What's more, Gelor argues that the great cogs of history continue to turn in ways that will inevitably improve human life on the planet. So, I wanted to know if the idea of the future as we understand it today really was a recent phenomenon, or if thinking about the future is actually something that is hardwired into us as human beings. I spoke to Dr. Alex Krotowski, a social psychologist, researcher, and science communicator, to find out. Why is it, as humans, we are so concerned with our future as individuals and the future of the planet, of societies, of humanity itself?
The most simple answer is simply survival, right? We as humans, as animals, are a social species. And so we need to know how to plan. We need to know how we are going to interact with one another and with our planet and with our resources as we propel ourselves forward. Ultimately, forward is the only direction that we can go. And I think that anybody who offers the view into the future, whether it's a justified or something that's fantastical, really does settle us and reduces our anxiety so that we can imagine where we're going to be. There was a research study that I have lent on in my life as a psychologist, as a social psychologist. It's a theory that that focuses on the description of the future self as the possible self. We are constantly inventing ourselves, constantly trying things on, taking them off, seeing if they fit, if they don't fit. And the reason that we do this is because we need to know how we fit in the world. And this idea that it is so fundamental to our psychologies that we imagine, that we play act, that we try on and take off these possible selves, I think is fundamental to how we operate and imagine what the future is going to be.
When did we become more interested in more what might be described as social, political, societal, the future of those things beyond, will I get my crops in on time and will I be able to feed my family over the next season?
Once we sort of settled, stopped being quite as nomadic, and our crops became more frequent and we kind of knew or were able to predict that we would have enough to eat, that we would be able to take care of our families. You know, we already had a sense that there were those who could be better at planning certain things or had some kind of imagining that they tapped into the physical and the social world, and we treated them as priests or as leaders within those communities. And so we've always had these social structures.
So it's clear there is a human instinct to predict the future. Now, I wanted to know, how have people attempted to predict the future throughout history? Here's Dr. Amanda Rees, a historian of science from the University of York.
If you think about past visions of the future, then you can think about it in terms of prediction and you can think about it in terms of prophecy. So you have, for example, the capacity of some individuals to prophesize what the future is going to be, either because they're God-touched, either because the divine has influenced them in some way, or because they have some kind of capacity, some kind of characteristic that enables them to access what you might call a different plane of being. You've also got more private kinds of predictions. So basically going to an astrologer and asking for your horoscope, systems of divination, so on and so forth, which are a bit different. They're not dependent on the intrinsic capacity of an individual, but they're an application of a particular kind of system.
Alexander Boxer is a data scientist and author of A Scheme of Heaven, Astrology and the Birth of Science.
Astrology and astrologers were not a sideshow in the history of science. They were the main event. This idea that you could use mathematics and that you could use numbers to describe the world and ourselves is something that we ascribe to very much today. I myself am not an astrologer. I don't believe in astrology. I have a PhD in physics from MIT, and I work very much in the world of machine learning and mathematical forecast. But in the ancient world, the underlying view of astrology was that the world was entirely predictable, that it was controlled by fate, and that if you simply could read the signs, of which the planets were one of many, then you could understand the future. But there was no opportunity to make anything better or to change the future. At best, if you knew the future, you could stoically inure yourself against it, but you couldn't change it. At the time, there was no sense that you could use astrology to, let's say, make the world a better place. Governments were interested in astrology because they wanted to know how long the emperor was going to live or when there was going to be an uprising. It was very much a tool of power.
From ancient Greek philosophers, you have this notion of kind of the world has fallen from a golden age, so that it's rather than steadily progressing towards something, we are constantly falling away from what was once our perfection, what was once our closeness to the gods. From other cultures, you have a notion of the time as a cycle, you know, as this is not time's arrow. This is actually, we're all at different stages on the cycle of life. And what goes around comes around. What did change in the 20th century, late 19th, 20th century, I would want to suggest, is more of a sense of the future as plannable. The future is something that you could plan, right? That you could take decisions in the present in order to shape the kind of future that you wanted to make. And this grows out partly out of the kind of the innovations in science and technology that are speeding up at this point in time. You've got characters like H.G. Wells, the famous science fiction writer, doing broadcasts on the BBC where he's essentially saying, look, why are we wasting all this money on writing and learning about history? And I'm saying this as a historian myself. Why are we wasting all this money on history when we need to be thinking about the future? We need professors of predestination. We need professors of foresight is what he was calling for. And it's quite easy to kind of sort of see who he thinks ought to be the first professor of foresight. It is dear old H.G. Wells, naturally.
Okay, Manu, you just unpack that a bit for me. I'm not a massive, I must admit, and I apologize for this, I'm not a huge science fiction reader, but just talk me through a bit of that. Because I must admit, in my rather ignorant way, I think of science fiction as sort of mostly men of a certain type writing about a post-apocalyptic world in a dystopian manner, which makes me feel a little depressed.
I think of science fiction as an experimental space for testing the future. It's not predicting the future in that sense, but it is testing out the likely social and economic consequences, particularly with reference to the fact that these consequences are differentially experienced by different groups. They're experienced differently by people of different genders, different sexualities, different ethnicities, different religious or different species, even if we want to talk science fiction here.
Why do you think that so many narratives about the future are dystopian, apocalyptic, as you say, rather than optimistic?
A key component of all kinds of future-oriented thinking is this dance, this dicky dance between utopia and dystopia. One person's utopia is going to be somebody else's dystopia.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theater, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind. So you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
Perhaps we need to be careful to separate out the concepts of prediction and planning when it comes to the future. We've seen how role-playing can help us imagine the impact of possible futures on society. But does the lure of prediction still linger? And what happens when we don't like what we hear? What does climate change tell us about our two things, our ability to predict the future, and second, once we can do that, does it show that actually human beings are much more interested in their present wants and desires than they are in where the world might be in even 50 years?
In the first instance, the first question, how are we at predicting the future? Well, we've got great models, I think. We have been predicting climate change for some time. Once we realized what it was we were doing, and I'm a child of the 80s, I remember very explicitly the fear about the hole in the ozone layer. We're pretty good at measuring and saying, hey, look, this is coming. What we're not so good at is communicating that and influencing, shall we say, or persuading people that such an existential threat is imminent and that we do need to do something about our present in order to change what our future is going to look like. That's very psychological. You know, you look at other sort of existential constructs, the belief in a philosophy, a power that is greater than oneself is itself an existential idea. Surely we should be able to come to terms with this existential idea that what we are doing to the planet is something that is extraordinarily harmful.
So rather than maybe explaining our lack of action on climate as nation states, as governments, and as individuals, as businesses, etc., rather than that being a function of selfishness, laziness, not realizing where the future is going, are you saying that actually that's because we are only really motivated to act when we can see almost literally in front of our noses the effects of what the future is bringing?
I would say yes, because ultimately it does come back to that idea of feeling like we can change, that we can predict, that we can strategize and do something.
The accuracy of our data and models for predicting the future has increased greatly over recent years. But has this actually helped us make political or social or economic decisions that lead to better outcomes? How can experts and scientists persuade us to be more long-term in our thinking and our actions?
A large component of data science is something I would call data rhetoric. You know, how do you actually use the data to persuade? And how you take this data and how you tell a persuasive story to get people to do A or to get people to do B is something that is of great interest today.
I sense a degree of skepticism from you about your notion of predicting the future. Should we just sort of give up and then just wake up every morning and if the sun's in the sky, then great, and I'll sort of go to work and that'll do? Or how do we fulfill the human desire for predicting the future?
Well, you know, I'm in this game too. I'm so interested in what we can know. The best way to predict the future is to make it. So people out there in the laboratories, in the field, you know, making the new technologies, those are the people we should be asking what the future is going to be.
With that in mind, I spoke to Dirk Helbing, Professor of Computational Social Science at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich. In 2010, he was at the helm of a remarkable project that aimed to help us predict and scenario plan for the future with greater accuracy than ever before. It was called Future ICT and was as ambitious as the Large Hadron Collider. It was a way to take the masses of data we have available to us and in a decentralized and distributed way use it to run simulations that could help us predict future events. It was made of three parts. The planetary nervous system would form a vast network of sensors monitoring socioeconomic, technological, and environmental systems. Think everything from GPS data from your smartphone to the movements of the FTSE 100. This would stream torrents of data into the Living Earth Simulator, a model of human society that would give us the answers to specific questions about what might happen in the future. Not like an oracle, but a way to test the interconnectedness of human systems. If we do A, what will happen to X, Y, and Z? The final part of the project was its open source aspect, a global participatory platform that would be an open framework for businesses, organizations, and ordinary people to share and explore data and simulations. The idea wasn't to give us a glimpse of the far future or the minutiae of daily life, but a greater understanding of how the many systems that make up human society actually work. Dirk, we live in an era of data. We live in an era of mass computation, which is getting ever faster. Are we in a sweet spot of predicting the future? Actually, we've now got the best opportunity we've ever had to know what is going to happen.
What we certainly can say is that we're living in times where it has become possible for some players to see basically what is happening on Earth in any spot of the world and at any time in very great detail. And that has created hopes that we would be able to predict the future and control it. That is, however, a lot more difficult as it turns out. So there are certainly attempts to build huge AI systems that do machine learning on all the data that's being created, and a lot more data than you would ever imagine, you know, in a lot more detail than you know of. But there is randomness and there is something that people call freedom of will. And basically that messes up basically with the predictions of the future. Right? So creativity, innovation, that is something that suddenly introduces novelty and surprise. And that basically makes even the best forecasts sometimes useless.
Do we know now, with more certainty than we ever have before, what the future maybe could hold or is likely to hold?
Well, we know a few things for sure, and this is not always a positive knowledge. Part of that is, about environmental destruction. It's about limitations of the Earth's resources, and that also implies there's a limited carrying capacity, and that's why people talk about overpopulation, and all of that has sometimes dramatic implications for the future. In a sense, we'll see in much more detail the apocalypse. And the question is that the tool that we do need, or do we need a tool that would help us basically to overcome this trouble and to open up a new chapter of history that would provide enough resources for everyone? Now, the question is, would all the data of the world help us to make a new start of a better world? Potentially so. But we need to be careful how to use that data. Because if we just feed it in the big computer, you know, perhaps a super intelligent computer, there's basically the danger of a lock-in effect. It would learn to continue in a similar way.
Wasn't it, Dirk, the very reason for what was the Living Earth Simulator project, to try and help us on that journey? Explain to us your role in that project and what that project was about.
We were all interested in basically addressing the grand challenges of the future, the great problems that humanity has to solve, including environmental problems, a better financial system, and so on. This would basically empower everyone with data to come up with better solutions for the future. That means very different from that kind of big machine that would control the entire world. We were aware that the world is a complex system. A complex system tends to self-organize and come up with often surprising behaviors, but in many cases it can be a positive thing, and we can use that self-organization actually for our purposes. If we understand those complex systems better, then we can just put the right kind of interactions in place to let the system evolve by itself into a favorable kind of state and behavior.
Now that sounds like such a radical idea. What gave you any confidence it would work?
Complexity science is really full of these examples. We've been working on that for quite some time. For example, we came up with a cruise control system for freeways that was able to dissolve traffic jams without a centralized traffic control center. just by changing the interactions between cars a little bit. That means the way cars would accelerate and decelerate in response to other cars. And we did a similar thing actually for traffic light control in cities. When we let the cars, the traffic flows, control the traffic lights rather than the other way around, traffic lights were less predictable, but travel times were much shorter, actually. So now that was to the benefit of the drivers, but also to the benefit of nature. By changing the way we control the system, namely here in a flexible and adaptive and distributed way, rather than a centralized control way. Using complexity as part of the solution, rather than as the enemy.
And what happened to what sounds like such a remarkable project?
Well, I think at that time the world was not ready for it yet. Big data was very much in the hands of very few players. There were some players, I think, who didn't want to share data and control with the citizens and with the rest of the world. And there was the idea that a centralized control and optimization approach would probably work better for the world. And, you know, in the first moment, it sounds plausible. If you have all the data in the world in one place, well, what could be better than that? That's what most people would think.
Do you think it's time to bring the simulator idea back, to refund it, to rediscover? Is it time now?
I think so.
I'm a child of the 80s. I was convinced that the bomb was going to drop, and it was just a question of what would I do with the 3 minutes between the sirens going off and my obliteration. But we are still here, so many years later, and I suppose in my rather simplistic way, that does make me optimistic. I wonder, why do we tend to catastrophize our immediate future, whereas the evidence suggests we do, in the end, progress? Is that Panglossian idiocy on my part, or are there some grains of truth there?
I think the nicest experiences we can make in our lives that if we're in trouble, somebody else is helping us. And I think people do have this desire to help other people, and in particular in difficult situations. So, you know, I do believe in a positive future. Disasters may happen, crises will be around, but we will need to be able to respond to those crises flexibly. I do believe together we'll be able to find ways and help each other to get through those difficult times that may be ahead.
I think we're very good at surviving. When I'm not doing the history of the future, I'm also studying human-animal relations. My PhD was on the history of primatology. One of the things that makes us stand out, one of the things that makes us different as a species, as Charlotte Slay and I said in our most recent book, Human, is that we are really good at cooperation, right? For all of the focus on competition, for all of the kind of discussions in kind of like popular evolutionary accounts of how everything is down to competition and the strongest, the fittest survive and all the rest of it, what humans are really good at doing is cooperating. We're good at working together in order to achieve things. And that, more than anything, does give me hope for the future. As individuals, we are naked apes, we are toothless, we are clawless, we are feeble. It's the capacity to cooperate and also the capacity to recognize the humanity in each other. We have a theory of mind, we have the capacity to recognize that other people have a perception of the world that is different to your own. But we can learn from that difference in perception. And we do, and we have, and we will.
Coming up in the Futureverse.
Join Y-Tree and Intelligence Squared to debate the motion. The world will be a better place in 5, 50, and 500 years.
I'd like to invite you to join me in a very special exploration of the future. Put the date in your diary, 3rd of May, at an exclusive venue in London, or available to live stream from wherever you are. I'll be joined on stage by the artist and sculptor Sir Anthony Gormley, moonshot technologist and happiness engineer Mo Gaudat, and climate activist Clover Hogan. We will explore the future of art and its role in the public space, how tech and artificial intelligence will evolve, and the intersection between these topics and happiness and creativity. Can we make the world a better place? How are we going to tackle the biggest issue of our time, climate change? To attend the event, go to y-tree.com/futureverse and visit intelligencesquared.com/futureverse for a wealth of information, including videos with some of our leading thinkers examining the future of their industries. Let us know what you think. #futureverse. And see you in the Futureverse. In the spirit of this wonderful podcast, give us your predictions 5 years, 50 years, 500 years.
Oh my goodness. I didn't know I'd be put on the spot.
Hands down, it's climate change. I mean, that is the number one thing that is going to dictate how we operate in the future.
I would say in 5 years' time, we'll have a different financial system.
One element of the future that I believe will happen, that I think oftentimes is underappreciated, is that I think the population will peak.
Oh, I really so much don't want to do this.
And 50 years' time will be humanity that travels space, will be connected with other planets.
It'll be a fascinating transition. How do you direct our economies, which are designed to sell more and more goods to more and more people, in a world where the people are older and there's fewer of them and there's just fewer people to sell to?
We are potentially going to see perhaps a shift away from the notion that you're either well or you're ill, one or the other, and to see instead, just start seeing kind of medical situations in rather more shades of grey, if that makes sense.
And in 500 years, we'll be still wondering about those strange times we've been in right now.
500 years still studying Donald Trump.
The Futureverse is powered by Y-Tree. In the future, wealth will be defined by how you live, not what you have. To truly understand and gain control of your complex financial life, you need transparency, efficiency, and understanding. Y-Tree is in the business of financial life intelligence. Combining data, experience, and technology, Y-Tree provides insight across all aspects of clients' financial profile.